Ata titzaveh es b'nei Yisrael v'ikhu eilecha shemen zayis zoch kosis lamaor lehalos ner tamid. Now you shall command the children of Israel that they shall take for you pure pressed olive oil for illumination, to kindle the lamp continually. OU Israel presents Welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Tetzaveh, Shabbat Zachor, Tarni Nester, which is today, and Purim, all rolled into one. Or not rolled into one, but sort of one flowing from the other, and we'll see what we could accomplish. Recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 11th day of Adar, 5777, corresponding this year to March 9th. The 11th of Adar is not usually Tani Dester, but it is this year. Purim, regular Purim as we call it, is the 14th of Adar. That's this Saturday night, Sunday. Tetvav, the 15th. Of Adar, which is called Shushan Purim, which we like to call Jerusalem Purim, is Sunday night, Monday. And the day before Purim is usually Tanit Esther. But that would put it on Shabbat, and we don't fast on Shabbat, with the exception of Yom Kippur. And therefore, rather than postponing Tanit Esther, which would be the way that we handle the fast days that are commemorative of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, Tzom Gedalia gets postponed to the following day, Shabbat. So does Tisha B'Av, so does Shivosar B'Tammuz. The only one that doesn't is, Asar B'Tevet, because in our calendar it can fall on Shabbat. When it happens to Tanit Esther, because it's not a sad day, it's a serious, sober day, word used on purpose, but it's not a sad day, then there is no hesitation, no need, let's say, to postpone it if it has to be moved. Furthermore, postponing it would be on top of Purim or Shushan Purim or after Purim, where it loses its effect. So instead, it is preponed. Pulled back, mukdam in Hebrew, to the previous Thursday. Why not Friday? Because once you're moving it off of Shabbat, you don't move it to Friday, which would encroach a little bit on Shabbat, as people will enter Shabbat hungry and in fasting. Whichever way you want to slice it, today, this year, is Ta'anit Esther. And there are a little bit of differences in the davening, especially at Mincha, because it's not followed by Purim anywhere, and therefore we do say Avinu Malkeinu and Tachanun, otherwise we don't. But I want to talk a little bit about Ta'anit Esther, but I have a few things to take care of first. First, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir Hama'alot, Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli, Tehiena Oznecha Kashuvot, L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avono Tishmarya Adonai Mi'amod, Ki Imacha Hasalicha L'Ma'an Tivare. Ki Viti Adonai Kivata Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hochalti. Nafshi L'Adonai Mishomerim L'Boker, Shomerim L'Boker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'Harbe Imo Fidut. Vehu Yifde Et Yisrael Mikol Avonotav. Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanatunim Batara V'Ashivya Ha'omedim V'en Bayam V'en Bayabasha Hamakom Yirachem Aleihem V'yotziyem Mitzara Lirvacha U'meafela La'ora U'mishibud L'Geula Hashta Ba'agala U'vizman Kariv V'nomar Amen. Second item is a matter of pride, Jewish pride, Israeli pride. I don't know how many of the listeners have been following the doings of the World Baseball Classic. These are competitions among countries in baseball that are scheduled to take place once in 4 years. It's fairly recent that this came about. I think it was about the time when the Olympics Committee decided to do away with baseball as one of the Olympic sports. So an international competition outside the Olympics grew up for baseball. Now, the way they work it is many, many countries vie for position to play. The competition itself, the World Baseball Classic, consists of 16 teams from 16 countries who play in four pools of four teams each. I'll get back to that in a moment. For the very first time ever in the young history of the World Baseball Classic, Israel qualified to be among the 16. The previous time, for 2009, they just missed it, but they are in this time. They came into this competition being ranked number 41 in the world of baseball, yet they made the 16 who compete. They came in as tremendous underdogs, and the odds of them winning were extremely long. They actually won their first game a couple of days ago against South Korea by the exciting 2-1 victory in 10 innings. They said then the next day won the game against Taiwan, which apparently is not the politically correct name for that country. It is now called Chinese Taipei, but we used to call it Taiwan, so we'll continue. They beat them 15-7. A close game, a squeaker as it is called, and a romp. Then they skipped a day and had their third and final game against Holland, the Netherlands, who had also previously beaten both Korea and Taiwan. And now Israel beat the Netherlands. So to put things in order, of the four teams in Pool A, Israel has a 3-0 record, Holland has 2-1, and each of the others are now standing at 0-2, but they are playing each other in the final game of the pool. So one of them will be 1-2, and the other will be 0-3. The top two teams go up to the next level, which is called for Israel Pool E. And Pool E will be the Netherlands, Israel, and the two that go up from the Pool B. Don't know who that is. I have to look it up again. So, A, that's very exciting. Now comes a few little pieces of information. tidbits, if you'd like to call them that. Eligibility for a baseball player to play on his country's team is either citizenship or eligibility for citizenship. Exactly what that means for Venezuela and for Puerto Rico and for Australia and for any of the other teams, what it means for us is that since Israel has a chok hashivut, the right of return, that says that any Jew or any person who has a Jewish grandfather or grandmother on either side is eligible for citizenship, and therefore Israel benefits from many different Jewish baseball players. It happens to be that there are only three Israeli citizens currently on the team, but the others are either Jewish or have a Jewish father, and they come mostly from the United States. There are no current major league players. There are some current minor league players playing for Team Israel, and there are a few recently former major leaguers who are also playing. Whatever. In addition, they have a mascot. The mascot is a full human-sized doll, stuffed doll, known as the Mensch on the Bench. It accompanied them during their qualifying rounds last September, and it is in Seoul, Korea, where he sat on the bench and gave encouragement to the players who have taken a shine to him. He looks like a kind-hearted rabbi with a little tallis, a candle in one hand, and a hat, and just looks like a very friendly guy, and he's doing a nice job with the team. In addition, and this is what really choked me up, before each game, the teams line up on the first baseline or the third baseline, and in universal baseball tradition, during the playing of the national anthem, and in these competitions, the two national anthems, you take off your baseball cap and you put it over your heart. Team Israel was photographed from behind them. When they took off their caps, every single player was wearing the team kippah. We're talking about people who are not necessarily religious, who don't wear kippot in their day-to-day lives. Some of them are not halachically Jewish. But Team Israel has baseball caps, jerseys, pants, socks, and shoes, and a kippah. Add that to the fact that they have played so far against three non-Jewish teams in the month of Adar, and that is a very good thing to do. So they are now 3-0, waiting for the results of the other pools, and then going up into the Pool E, where hopefully they will be as successful and advance further. And it's very exciting. I happen to have bought a cap on the internet, and a cousin of mine brought it the beginning of the week, just in time for the first game. Truth is, I was a little apprehensive in how long I'd be able to wear the cap, but by this time, you could sleep in it and be proud to wear the Team Israel cap. It's a stylized eye in a Magen David, with the Israeli flag on the side, and the New Age logo, New Wave, whatever it's called, New Wave logo for the manufacturer. It's very, very exciting if you're that type of person. If you love baseball and you love Israel and you live in Israel and you lament the demise of the league which we reveled in back in summer of 2007, don't get me started on that, but I went to 13 games during that short summer season. and the league collapsed thereafter. But that was very exciting, and people got to know baseball. More people got to know baseball. So certainly Americans who live in Israel are very into this, as well as spring training and the anticipation of the coming baseball season. But very exciting, and that's Team Israel, and I wanted to share it with you. Next, I guess we're back to Tanit Esther. So in order for me to lead into Tanit Esther, I want to tell you a mashal, a parable. Part of it you could go all the way with, and you have to be careful how you apply it. But here it is. An 8-year-old boy loves coloring in his coloring books. And an uncle, for his birthday, got him the gift of the super-duper box of Crayola crayons. I did not have a chance to look up what the latest super-duper is, but in my childhood, the super-duper box was 128 different colors with a built-in crayon sharpener. And the uncle gives the kid that box of crayons, and the kid is over the moon. One afternoon after school, he's home, and his parents, father's at work, his mother goes out shopping, leaves him in the house. He's old enough, and if not, change the story to a 10-year-old. Then you have to explain why he likes coloring and coloring a book so much, but hopefully you'll get the point, no matter how long it takes me to get there. 8-year-old boy colors beautifully, and he draws in his parents' absence beautiful, beautiful pictures all over the walls in the kitchen. Needless to say, the parents get home and they flip out and they yell at him and they hand him a bucket of soapy water and he has to scrub the walls until they're spotless. First level of punishment. I don't even know if you could call that a punishment. That's the immediate thing that has to be done. And now they sit him down and they give him a lecture about how wrong it is to color on the walls of the kitchen. Now comes two further steps. They said, young man, give me that box of crayons, the father says. You will not have these crayons for 1 month. And hopefully then you'll have learned your lesson. The next afternoon, kid comes home from school. The mother sits the kid down with blank sheets of paper, hands him his box of crayons, and tells him that he's to color pictures for the next half hour. And after that, they're going to go to the local hospital and visit the children's ward and hang up these pictures to help brighten their day. That's the mashal. Mashal l'maha davar domeh. First, we should talk about the mashal a little bit more. Does the kid understand? If not, he has to be explained. Why his repair, tikkun, of his sin, whatever you want to label it, comes in two forms. The crayons that you misused, you shall not be allowed to use for a month. The crayons that you misused shall be used by you for a mitzvah. And these are two different ways, not incompatible, but they're definitely two different ways to handle the aftermath of the kid's drawing on the wall. Now let's get back to the Purim story. Question that a lot of commentaries handle is what the Jews of Ahasuerus' kingdom did to deserve being subjected to the threat of annihilation. I want to make a point here also that when an enemy threatens us with annihilation, whether they succeed partially or not at all, is God's choice. But the threat of annihilation is their choice. And we need to react, not knowing what the end result is going to be, with the seriousness of that goes along with a threat of annihilation. When rockets are fired from Gaza to southern communities in Israel, and the news reports 3 rockets were fired today, they landed in an empty field and exploded there, no injuries or damage reported, not the way that you have to relate to what happened. 3 rockets are fired from Gaza with intention of harming and killing Jews. The fact that they didn't succeed this time or that time, we say thanks to God. But the fact of the matter is that the threat is disruptive. Kids have to get used to running to shelters when they hear a siren, even if they get the all clear sign later and nothing has happened in between, it's still psychologically damaging and harmful. It's not a good situation. So what did the Jews in the kingdom of Ahasuerus do to deserve the threat of annihilation at the hands of Haman? The famous answer is they attended the banquets of Ahasuerus, which are recorded in the beginning of the Megillah. They ate and they drank. Different opinions as to whether they ate and drank non-kosher or even if they were catered for. They still ate and drank as if nothing was wrong when Ahasuerus was displaying the plunder of the Beit HaMikdash, which he had stolen from Vashti's grandfather, paraded around in the garments of the Kohen Gadol, pronounced and announced to everyone that he, Ahasuerus, is greater than the God of Israel because the Beit HaMikdash is in ruin and I have the vessels and the garments to prove it. No Jew should have attended those parties. And therefore, at least based on my mashal, the sin was a sin of inappropriate eating and drinking. Come our sages and say 2 things. On the day before Purim, the day that really marks the fighting against our enemies, we shall not eat or drink at all. That's called a fast day, and we call it Tani Nester. But then comes Purim, and Purim takes the other direction. Says to us, eating and drinking, yes, nothing intrinsically wrong with eating and drinking unless you do it for the wrong reason. So you will now eat and drink l'shem mitzvah, for the sake of the mitzvah. Now, our eating and drinking is guided by the laws of kashrut, guided by the laws of brachot, and many other halachic issues that point to the fact that our act of eating is elevated above the mundane basic need of all living beings, food, to a level where we add a dimension of spirituality to our everyday lives and everyday living. And that's what's reflected in the Purim laws of Seudat Purim, a festive meal, of drinking Ad Lo Yada, of giving gifts to friends and giving gifts to poor people, all around the theme of food, to say, now you've got it straight. Now your food is not a sign of disrespect to God, but your food is for the sake of the mitzvah. And that's very important. With this week's Sedra, last week's Sedra, next week's Sedra, we can take that same mushal and apply it to two more areas, not related to Purim, but related to the Torah. Gold reminds us of the sin of the golden calf fiasco. And as a result of having sinned with gold, the Kohen Gadol, spiritual representative of the people, is told on Yom Kippur, when you enter the Kodshei Kodashim, the Holy of Holies, you shall first wash your hands, remove your regular garments, the eight garments, wash, go to mikveh, wash again, and then put on four very special linen garments, and only without the gold shall you go into Kodshei Kodashim at this sensitive moment. Yet, so that would be like saying to the kid, give me those crayons. Crayons are, you know, picture the kid sneaking into his father's room, taking the crayons, and writing an apology letter. You write it with pencil or pen, maybe it could be accepted. You write it with the crayons that were confiscated from you, it doesn't work. Crayons, your crayons, are a damning piece of evidence. They are, in the language of the Gemara, the kategor, the accuser. Ein kategor nasa sanegor, an accusing, damning piece of evidence does not come in favor of the person, leads or explains why the Kohen Gadol does not wear gold when he goes into Kodshei Kodashim. But wait a minute. Do you know what the Kohen Gadol takes with him into Kodshei Kodashim? A gold fire pan with hot coals from the golden Mizbeach, with the incense. And he goes into Kodshei Kodashim, and you know what he finds there? An aron plated with gold, with a gold, solid gold lid, with two cherubs emanating from the solid gold cover. So which is it? Well, the boy had not only to lose his crayons, but also, at the same time, had to use his crayons for a very constructive purpose. So it's as if God says to us, not only you misused gold, so you shall not use it. No, you missed gold, so the Kohen Gadol doesn't go in with his gold garments on Yom Kippur, but the rest of you, repent. You have to do tshuva. You have to do community service. Whatever it is involved will be involved with those objects which were once associated with doing the wrong thing and now are used for the good things. That is the quality of more than punishment, of something that we could call tikkun. One more related issue, and that is the cow. A shofar on Rosh Hashanah, Judgment Day, that calls out to God from the innermost depths of our primitive soul and heart, and calls us to repent, can come from any kosher animal except the cow family. Because the cow family reminds us of Egel HaZahav, the golden calf, and Ein Kategor Naseh Sanegor. Okay, there's the taking away the crayons from the kid. You can't use a cow's horn for shofar on Rosh Hashanah, because it will remind us of Egel HaZahav. Guess what the first korban, first animal sacrifice in the Mishkan in its inauguration period was? It was a bull, the father of the calf. coming to atone for his son. Well, which is it? The answer is it's both. Para Aduma is known as a kapara, an atonement for chet hamaraglim. Sorry, for chet ha'egel. Chet ha'egel sinned with a cow. The sacrifices of a par, not just that first time, but all the parim, and on Rosh Hashanah and on Yom Kippur, are all a tikkun of the misuse of the par's son, the calf. So it fits from both of those, both from the golden and from the calf side, and translates into Tanit Esther and Purim with eating and drinking. And it all happens at this time of the year. We started the show at the beginning, 30 seconds or so, of V'nahafochu, that the tables were turned during the month of Adar. As I mentioned briefly before, it shows up in Israel's first three victories. May they continue. And it's one of the songs of Purim, because it looked black and it turned around for us. V'nahafochu.
Hi.
Okay, that's what I had to say about Tanya Dester. Let's try to move on because I don't have an unlimited amount of time for the show. We have Mincha and a mini shear and Myriv and refreshments coming up in a little while. I want to talk a little bit about Zachor, Eta Sheres Alecha Amalek. And I would like to do it in the form of connecting the dots. Let's start not at the beginning, but start with the nation of Amalek. The end of Parshat Peshalach, the last nine psukim, make up the Torah reading of Purim morning. Vayavo Amalek, vayilochem im Yisrael birafidim. Amalek came and attacked Bnei Yisrael and did battle against them in the location of Rephidim. This was met by Moshe telling Yehoshua to gather an army and fight against Amalek. It was met by Moshe, Aaron, and Hur going up to a hilltop and in essence praying for the success of the Israelite army. It was also combined with God's making himself a partner with us in our perpetual fight, perennial fight against Amalek, where God says, Emche et Zecher Amalek, I will wipe them out, the remnant, and yet it keeps happening from generation to generation. So what the Torah says there is Vayachalosh Yehoshua at Amalek, he weakened them, didn't vanquish them. This keeps going. 400 years later, Shmuel Hanavi tells Shaul HaMelech, you've got a golden opportunity here to wipe out Amalek. Men, women, and children, animals, the works, destroy completely. Shaul doesn't listen. He keeps Agag, the king of Amalek, alive. And our tradition has it that he was able to impregnate a concubine of his that night before he was killed by Shmuel HaNavi, and Amalek perpetuated. And the cattle, another issue. Okay, we'll leave that. Now, about 500 years later, comes Haman, a descendant of Amalek, of Agag, king of Amalek, and Mordechai, from the same tribe and a descendant of Shaul HaMelech, does battle against Haman and succeeds. And now with these three events, by the way, the story with Shaul and Shmuel is the Haftorah of Parshat Zachor. The Torah reading of Purim morning is the Vayavo Amalek, and of course the Mordechai Esther story against Haman and his gang is the Megillah. Now let's go backwards in time, connecting the dots to Esav and his hatred of Yaakov, to Esav passing on the baton of hatred through his son Eliphaz, through grandson Amalek, the ancestor of the Amalek nation. And that is where it starts and connects to the Vayavo Amalek that we said, to the Shmuel and Shaul thing, and to the Megillah. Now let's go further. Throughout Jewish history, we have been subject to the threat of annihilation from many different Amalek types. Not arguing genetics here or biological connection, but certainly attitude and spirit connection. We have had many, many Amaleks poised to attack us throughout history. A major recent, fairly recent example of this, of course, is the Shoah during World War II. There is an amazing story that, I don't know, if it's read and you find out about it for the first time the right way, It could blow your mind. On October 16th, 1946, Nazi high-ranking officials who were sentenced to death at the Nuremberg trials were executed by hanging. The day was Hoshana Rabbah, the end of the period of judgment of all human beings by God. That already shakes you up. The fact of the matter is, they were 11 Nazis who were to be hanged, and one of them, Hermann Göring, killed himself the night before, leaving 10 modern-day sons of Haman to hang. That by itself shakes you a little. And then you take a look at the scribal minhag, the custom of writing the Megillah. In the portion of the 10 sons of Haman who were hanged on the same day, there are 3 letters that are written tiny and 1 letter that's written extra large. The extra large letter looks like is a vav, and it could be, in your imagination, a gallows, a tall post and a little chipchick to hold the rope and to hang. The 3 small letters are a tuf. These are all in names of someone's, Haman's sons. A tuf, a shin, and a zayin. Tuf Shin Zayin is a Hebrew year of 1946-1947. The Nuremberg executions of 10 modern-day sons of Haman took place in the year Tuf Shin Zayin, where that year is built in on a remez level in the Megillah itself. Think about that one. My point in linking all of the things up through the Nazi era, and really till today also, any non-Jew, non-Jewish nation whose leaders openly come out in favor of the destruction of Jews, the destruction of Israel, the state of Israel, Israelis, is an Amalek type. Yes, you can argue that Amalek had no motive, and some people today have a motive, but really, that's picky compared with the main issue. The main issue is the desire and the threat to annihilate the Jews. And you could argue from today till tomorrow that Israel and Jews are not synonymous. They are. In fact, that's what Israel has been pushing for, recognition of itself as a Jewish state. That's what its Declaration of Independence in 1948 declared it as such. And that's what it is. And it doesn't matter how many non-Jews are here and how many Arabs are here and how many Christians and how many others. This is a Jewish state. And every non-Jew needs to know it and appreciate it, as well as all the Jews, and decide you're going to get along with your neighbors and with your community. And all of these stressful discussions on the internet and the memories of the wrong kind of symbol for the day and the right kind of symbol for the day, and so on and so forth. It shall come as no surprise that I have plenty of things to say and not enough time to say them. I could say that about every show, this one maybe in particular, because Purim has so many things to explore. I want to touch upon one other aspect, which until I came in Aliyah, until I lived in Yerushalayim, until I experienced it firsthand year after year after year, finally penetrates. And that is the 2 days of Purim. Yud Dalid for war, for open cities, and Tet Vav for walled cities. Now, without going through the whole history of it, I want to start by saying that there are no rules as to how our sages are to declare a holiday. Even in modern times, 6 day war, a miraculous victory of the few over the many, definitely a cause to make a fuss about, a cause to have a holiday. And in fact, in Israel, we have a holiday. It's called Yom Yerushalayim. But it's not a 6 day holiday. If it would be, we wouldn't be surprised because of the correspondence, but it doesn't have to be that way. Hanukkah was a great military victory, icing on the cake, cherry on the top of the sundae, whatever, was the miracle of the oil. Could have been a one-day holiday. It was an eight-day holiday. It is an eight-day holiday. But there is no behechrich. No, it has to be like that. Okay, more to the point. Purim could have been a one-day shot. Could have been a two-day shot. But unusual, it is 1 day in certain cities and a second day in other cities. And more than that is, it has evolved to today when you really don't talk about walled cities. You talk about Yerushalayim, Jerusalem. The bottom line, without getting into the whole thing, there are many cities that are question mark and different customs in those cities, but there is one city that everybody considers to be obligatory Purim on the 15th of Adar, and that is Jerusalem. And every place else celebrates Purim on Yud Dalid, the 14th. What does that say? And what it says is the fact that the story of Purim happened during exile in dispersion among the kingdom of Ahasuerus and elsewhere. It happened because Yerushalayim was in ruin. The Megillah mentions Shushan HaBira, if I'm not mistaken, 11 times, mentions Yerushalayim only once in describing this Jewish guy, Mordechai, Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, Ish Yemini, Asher Hagla Mirushalayim. He was exiled from Jerusalem. That's who Mordechai is. And Jerusalem's being in ruin led to this story. So that when Purim in perpetuity is celebrated by everybody on the 14th of Adar, and by the people of Yerushalayim, not the people of Shushan. I don't know if there are any Jews in what used to be Shushan. I know that here in Yerushalayim, there is a shul that I davened in once on a Friday night of Olei Shushan HaBira, Jews who came on Aliyah from that part of Iran. The point again, Jerusalem gets a certain attention and focus by the way the observance of Purim is done. And that's good, because Jerusalem was rebuilt shortly after the Purim story. Unfortunately, not as many people came as should have, and it was had its problems, and therefore, we have to do it again, and hopefully soon. So the whole story of Megillah, aside from being we were saved from the threat of annihilation, is a focus and a pointing towards Jerusalem by virtue of the split of observances between the 14th and the 15th of Adar. So wherever you are, and whichever day you celebrate, and some people celebrate both, because they know where to be in the right time and then where to return to in the right time, have a very happy Purim. Before that, I should say Shabbat Shalom. And have a happy Purim on both days, whether it's your day or not. Do something special. And L'Hishtameah. All right, I don't know what happened. I was just putting in a final song, and I found that the Zachor Timocho Macho Timcheh is in the wrong place. Let's chalk it up all to Vin Hafochu. I don't have time to correct it, so at the end of this song will be La'Yehudim Hayita Orav Simcha Bisason Vikor, and happy Purim.
Ahai, can't be a love.